You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, December 22nd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
We are live streaming to our Facebook page from the SGU studios in an undisclosed location inside our starship. And Kara is joining us via subspace.
And satellite feed, yeah.
That's your office, huh, Kara? That's where it all happens?
Oh, yeah, but it's also in a spaceship, if you didn't notice.
Yes. That's why you're wearing the Battlestar Galactica shirt.
Yeah, that's right.
I took off the red hoodie.
That's okay.
Now, look, from Kara's planet, dinosaurs are, like, tiny. Is that what she's wearing?
That's
a full-size Tyrannosaurus Rex.
We're going to start with the science news items that rocked 2017. Bob, you want to start? Pick one that you thought was particularly interesting.
It was nothing.
You got nothing?
Yeah. For me, there was a lot of great stuff. For me, the detection of a kilonova was huge on so many levels. Kilonova is basically two colliding neutron stars. We talked about that on one of the shows. It was detected using gravitational wave astronomy, which is a new branch of astronomy that was so transformative and awesome that it got its own Nobel Prize this year. Hello. Mm-hmm. And then they announced this, which is like the total icing on the cake. And this was mega news for many reasons. First off, we used gravitational wave astronomy to see these colliding neutron stars. It's been theorized for years. We never could really detect one. We detected one. But not only that, once that was detected with the gravitational waves, then they saw it optically. They saw it in electromagnetic radiation. That's never been done before.
So I put up a picture of LIGO because it really helps you understand what's happening. Right? So that is, you're seeing the two paths that the laser beams take, and then they merge at the intersection, and there's interference, right? Because light travels as a wave. And right. The interference can be teeny tiny, you know what I mean?
We're talking smaller than the size of a proton. It's unbelievably, unimaginably tiny. So one tiny little squishing of space-time in one direction, and you know something is up because of the interference between the two laser beams.
Yeah,
and then if you have other facilities around the world, you can then really focus in on where this is coming from. And because we've got three currently, we knew very precisely where this was, about 130 million light years away, I think.
Yeah.
Now, Bob, where are those two laser beams, that building where the two laser beams...
Where they converge.
Converge.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that time stops in that building?
No time stop.
It's not the science fiction segment.
So this is a new era of what they call multi-messenger astronomy, because we've got messages coming from, electromagnetic radiation, which we've had for forever.
Ever.
And now we're adding to that gravitational waves as well. Check this out. There was a scientific article published about this, of course. Did you guess how many scientists contributed to that article? 3,674 scientists all contributed to this description of exactly what happened. It was like 800 institutions contributed. Just a huge, huge event in astronomy. And for me, one of the number one scientific events of the year, 2017.
Definitely.
Huge. They're now thinking, they weren't sure what the remnant is from this neutron star collision, because you could have a kind of a hyper neutron star, just a really big neutron star. That's mm-hmm. possible. And they thought maybe that's what happened earlier, but now they're thinking that it's a black hole, that it looks like the remnant right now is, and it makes sense. Two big mm-hmm. neutron stars, you can have a black hole.
Yeah.
So that's what's probably there right now.
So I think this is the year though. I mean, 2015, right? It was when the first gravitational waves were detected, but this is the year where, like, there's no question now that we know these things are happening on a regular basis. It wasn't a fluke. It wasn't a rare event. You know what I mean? Now we know that gravitational wave astronomy is a thing.
Absolutely.
I think gravitational wave astronomy did turn a corner this year.
It really
worth
did.
Worth mentioning.
It's just going to get bigger and better with more of these facilities. They're planning one in space, which is going to be...
Awesome.
Satellites in space. My God, yeah, that's going to really add another layer, of accuracy and precision. It's just going to be amazing. We're going to really be able to pinpoint to pinpoint exactly where these things are happening and with much more detail. And also, once they get bigger and even more powerful, we can discover other types of gravitational waves like the ones that created by the Big Bang, because we're not there yet. We can't even do that, come close to that yet. But in the future, using this type of technology, we could learn things about the Big Bang that we can't, because right now, because after the Big Bang, it was 300,000 years is when light was kind of set free in the universe, and that's the earliest you could see optically. But gravitational waves were being emitted right after the Big Bang, so we could literally get to like fractions of a second after the Big Bang and find out what was going on. Right now, we have no idea what was going on. I mean, physics, it was infinities everywhere. You don't know what the hell is going on.
So I just think it's cool to think about, but those gravitational waves that were emitted by the Big Bang, you think about the universe is expanding, wouldn't they all just be on the outer perimeter? I know that might, from a physicist might be like, oh my God, Jay, I know, I don't know. I just don't understand though. Like, it's not like the waves are coming from somewhere that we can point to in space.
Right, it's coming from everywhere, because we're all like basically the center of the universe.
Yeah,
right?
We're all on that.
It's coming from everywhere, and as the universe expands, it's kind of stretching them out too.
Yeah.
So, like redshift,
you mean? Kind of like a redshift. Okay.
What do you got, Jay?
CRISPR all the way. CRISPR is the only thing that's going to save humanity at this point. This year, CRISPR got sharper, got better. CRISPR can now, first off, we can make more accurate changes to DNA.
Right down to the single nucleotide, right?
Yep. And
does it get any more granular than that?
And we can change RNA now.
Right. And the big bonus for that was... The big bonus for that is that if you make a change to DNA, that's it. Your genome's set. Your great-grandkids are going to have that change, good or bad. So the benefit of this is that if it's an RNA, which is kind of like an intermediary step before the proteins are created, right, then it's transient. It's like, okay, it works. That's great. But if the shit hits the fan, it's like, well, it doesn't matter because this isn't going to affect your kids or your grandkids.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big concerns about human genome editing is that if it gets into the germline, then you're basically permanently adding engineered genes into human civilization, into the population. Yeah.
But related to that, though, Jay, also 2017 was a banner year for gene therapy in general. The FDA, I think, approved. They voted on and approved of like three separate gene therapy. What you call them? Treatments.
Yeah.
For people. Like one was, Luxturna, which is for adults and kids, which, with an inherited form of vision loss that can result in blindness. I mean, and then there's like two others that they're also, even this other generic type of gene therapy that's not really based on CRISPR, because I don't think any of that's related, based on CRISPR. It's some other vectors I think they're using.
Someone asked us, what happens if it gets in the germline?
Then it gets passed down.
Yeah, then it's there. It could potentially just keep spreading through,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, CRISPR is not necessarily improving by leaps and bounds, but it is kind of a slow and steady, but man, it's just plodding along.
No, I think we're on the steep part of the curve still, though, with CRISPR technology. Because battery and solar technology, I follow it very closely. It's this steady, incremental, like they could tell you, yep, it's going to increase by 1% a year. That's just the way it's been going. CRISPR, it's like, oh, now we're like much more precise than we used to be. Now we can go down to just one nucleotide. I mean, they're learning a lot about it. The technology is dramatically improving. And then it'll level off and get to the point where we're settling into incremental improvements.
Okay, yeah, I guess you're right.
We haven't heard the last of this yet, in my opinion, in terms of just the technology itself, let alone the applications. We're really just getting started. All right, my news item for this year is all of the human evolution fossils and stuff that we found. It was one after another. We had the better dating for Homo naledi, for example, the Gregopithecus, which was the fossils that could be a very early human ancestor around the time that we split from the chimps, but outside of Africa. And then there was that was naledi. Then there was the Jebel Inhud Homo sapiens specimen from 315,000 years ago. So
Littlefoot
just found recently. Yeah. I mean, there's so many. And what we're discovering, I know we said this a lot on the show, what we're discovering is that every time we find a new piece to this puzzle, we realize, oh, my God, the puzzle's bigger. Yeah. We're not just filling in. We're expanding it. And it's like, oh, the relationships are really complicated. Forget any notion of any kind of linear progression. Yeah. Not only is it not a ladder, it's a bush. And not only is it bush, but... the connections are really complicated, and you need lots of pieces to the lots of puzzle pieces before we can really get a clear image of what evolved from what when. So right now we're in that part of the discovery where every time we find a new piece of information, we realize that we know less.
Yeah.
You know, that
right.
the unknown unknowns are still growing, being converted into known unknowns. Right? So the known unknowns are increasing.
In general, though, that's wisdom, right?
Yeah, that's
oh, yeah.
You,
it's all, expected.
All that's scientists science. Have to pass through
that's
that
science.
Phase. Yeah.
But it's funny, it's a great mental image because our mom is a great puzzle person. we often will get her, you know, these 5,000 piece puzzle sets. And I'm just picturing her at the table putting puzzle pieces in. And then she puts one in, and then all of a sudden it gets bigger over here.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
They just invented a video game, Bob. That's pretty cool.
That's a great analogy. Yeah.
Evan, science items this week?
For me, it was the solar eclipse, 2017, yep. August 21st. And I know for Kara as well, this was a huge science event. For her. I mean, this is something I've been looking forward to for...
Oh, you were a kid.
Oh, yeah. Decades. All my life, I like to express it. And it finally did happen, as it was expected to yep. certainly happen.
And you had a good view.
I had a fantastic view. Yep. Yeah, heading out to Oregon. So, what else was really going on in the news for the month, basically, of August, leading up to it? Every day, there were new and fascinating stories about the solar eclipse, the history of the solar eclipse, the importance of solar eclipses, what we learned from observing solar eclipses. It became solar eclipse sort of mania all across the country.
So I talked to a lot of people that saw the eclipse or tried to, and unfortunately there's some sad stories, and there are people going to great locations, being in the optimal path and not seeing it. But I was really blown away. I mean, Iran, our friend from Australia, mm-hmm. Iran's story, you know, he told me like a 20-minute story of the whole thing from his perspective. And he's like, you know, it's like a tearjerker.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so committed not to miss the next one, Ev. Like, we have to plan it and get a hotel room or whatever,
oh my God.
Make sure that we could do this.
Absolutely. April 8th, 2024.
Yep.
For the United States. There'll be a few others around the world before then, but for the U.S., that's
so
the next
Karen, one. Let's definitely get your perspective on the eclipse for this year.
Yeah, I mean, I am so sad that you guys missed it, because I know you saw a partial eclipse, but a partial eclipse is not totality.
No,
it's such a different experience. And so I thought I knew what to expect. I read a lot about it. It was weird because I was on camera, and so I had to maintain composure to some extent, but I did cry in the middle of the live stream. You know, I couldn't keep myself from doing that, and I really didn't want to. But really experiencing the sights and the sounds and the temperature, like the actual physical sensations that come along with the eclipse, it's like nothing you've ever seen. It's like being on an alien planet.
There's something psychological about that, about something happening in the celestial realm, you know? Like, I don't know, do you guys ever have dreams where there's something happening in the sky?
Yeah.
It is profound.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
It is profound. And the experience of the moon blocking the sun, you don't see the moon anymore. It just looks like there's a hole in the sun, like there's a hole in the sky. And where the light is coming from is very different than what we're used to experiencing. And I don't think we realize it, but when every day the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and when every single day, you know, that time of day looks like that outside, and you have these slow changes that occur with the seasons, and then all of a sudden there's a celestial, I mean, really, it was a lunar event, but it felt like a celestial event that makes the sky wrong.
It's so shaking. And it
touches you deeply.
Like, imagine thousands of years ago how people would have reacted without the knowledge of what was actually happening.
Oh, yeah. We all knew what was happening, and still people were like, ah!
Absolutely. Yeah.
I hate when the sky's wrong.
The sky's wrong. That's what happened. And I have to say, unless we're still talking about the eclipse, that there was another really great event this year we've got to remember. And it happened on April 22nd. Now, you know, every year that's Earth Day on April 22nd, but this year it was the March for Science.
Sure was.
Yeah.
And it was really an important event. A lot of people rally together. I felt a lot of camaraderie with not just scientists, but science enthusiasts. And again, I had the honor to co-host the event with Derek Muller and Questlove Gomez in Washington, D.C. And it was like really inspirational, really meaningful. I got to interview kids in the audience and ask them why they were there. And they're dressed up as scientists. And, you know, there were roboticists and all of these really great people that I learned a lot from. But even more than that, I think that it was an opportunity to celebrate science in a really unified way, a way that we don't often get to do.
Not nearly enough, right?
Yeah.
We went up to Boston and went to the event there. And yeah, it was great. Just great to see thousands of people out, you know, celebrating the awesomeness of science, you know, just reading all the signs and the t-shirts and everything. It was great.
Hey, a lot of comments are coming in about lava tubes.
Yeah. A couple, you know, Mars and have lava tube news. So
yeah, that was a fun story to cover. Essentially huge lava tubes that, from what we can glean, they're talking tubes that can hold a city, thousands of people. Yeah. Because like I said on the show, the surface of the moon is deadly. I mean, deadlier than you think. I mean, sure, we were there for a few days, and a few days is nothing. If you're going to stay there for a few months, you need cover. You need to get under that ground, whether you bury that habitat or go into the lava tube. You really need that because it's nasty on that surface. My God, radiation hitting you. Radiation hitting the ground and then spilling extra radiation onto your feet. I mean, it's just like, you're just screwed.
Right. And micrometeorites, too.
They don't just take you out like that. I mean, and even if they don't hit you, if they hit over here, the debris, it'll throw you away, could take you out. I mean, it's not a fun place. You know, if there's a solar flare, forget it.
Good luck running away, too. Yeah,
and the same is true on Mars. Yep. Same is true on Mars. The
atmosphere
is insignificant.
Junk. It's like little spots of some protection.
Mostly in the southern part.
Yeah, you guys seen that TV show about Mars, about colonizing Mars?
No.
The National Geographic show?
I think so. It's just called
Mars. The scripted show. Super cool.
Yeah, very good. And they occupy a lava tube, basically, in underground caverns.
Smart. Why not?
Well, you have to. Either that or you need to build a habitat that is that robust. But it's just so much easier to be under.
It's already there.
10 or 20 feet of dirt, you know, or a rock. Absolutely. Now, we'll be living under the ground on the moon.
I thought you were going to bring up The Expanse, which is my favorite sci-fi show.
Yeah, you're watching it now, right? You're going through it now, right?
Halfway through season two, and I love it. Characters are great. The storyline is solid. You know what I noticed? Real quick, I know, you know, won't get too deep into it, but the plot moves forward fast.
Yes, I love that.
They are not afraid to make things happen. You know, when you ever watch a TV show and you're like,
happens.
Man, Lost, like, and I won't, you know, I know there's people out there that love Lost. I think there's a person in the room that loves Lost. Lost took forever to get nowhere.
Yeah.
This show, every single show, I'm like, wow, they pulled the trigger on that. They pulled the trigger on that. They kept going. So guys, watch The Expanse. You'll love it.
I have friends who are not science enthusiasts by any stretch or skeptics or really much of anything. And they've seen The Expanse and they love it. They think it's the best show on television.
It's great television.
It's Game of Thrones in space.
And it's the best sci-fi on television.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
High quality.
It's not as good as Game of Thrones.
But you it's could very see too different to really compare.
Yeah,
but,
there are. Yeah. But what they wanted to do. This is the Sci-Fi Channel, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of the Sci-Fi Channel, I mean, you're not thinking of good sci-fi. You're not thinking of good anything, really, at this point. They wanted to really kind of redeem themselves.
Yeah. Well, they did.
And they did. And they threw some solid money at this show. Yeah. I mean, many millions of dollars. And you could see it. I mean, the graphics are fantastic. The acting, the writing. This is a dense, complex plot. Mm-hmm. This isn't just like, you know, fluffy sci-fi.
No, it's hard science.
It's hard science, which is something that you don't see very much at all.
I love that when you watch the show, you can tell that the writers are science influenced, right?
Right.
They're saying, okay, we have to do this, we have to do that to keep things making sense and to make it be in the world of physics. They're not breaking the rules.
Which is
wonderful.
And there's a couple of gimmies here that reveal themselves later on in the series. But that's fine. Gimmies are
it's science fiction.
It's science fiction. There's going to be some gimmies here and there. But overall, the science is hard and fascinating. Yeah.
So, guys, what surprised you this year? What was the most surprising thing, science related or skepticism related? I'll give you mine while you're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of answers to that question.
Yeah. So, I mean, I still have to say that the idea that there are people around today who believe the world is flat still blows me away. It blows me away. And they really do. Every time we talk about people, like, they don't really believe it. They're punking you. No. There are people who actually believe it. The power of just a YouTube video is amazing, just to bamboozle people. And it's a number of things simultaneously, right? It's the power of social media. Mm-hmm. It's the scientific illiteracy. I mean, you can't know what's going on and entertain for even a moment that the world is flat.
Yep.
And then just the distrust of expertise, of experts, of scientists, of authorities. You need all of those things
at pathological levels.
All those things have to conspire together. I wrote recently on my blog about the return of Lysenkoism in Russia. That's the same thing. So Lysenko was a total crank, right? This guy, you know, this is early 20th century in the Soviet Union, a complete and total crank who came to the attention of Stalin, and because his ideas about agriculture and biology fit well with communist ideology. He did not believe in genes, did not believe in Darwinian evolution. He believed in the inheritance of acquired characteristics. And he was basically put in charge of agriculture. And his ideas got spread to China and other communist countries, arguably responsible for millions of deaths through starvation, decimated the scientific infrastructure of the Soviet Union, set them back, their genetics back 50 years by conservative estimates.
And it's on the rebound?
And now people are starting to, you know, because he represents Russian culture and was very anti-West. And again, it resonates ideologically. And so he's starting to become popular again, still on the fringe, but like Flat Earth is, but that's like their Flat Earth is like Lysenkoism. Like, really?
That is so scary.
And
it's, you know, it seems like it's something that happens when we get comfortable.
Yeah.
And we have to be vigilant about that. Do you want to know something kind of interesting about Lysenkoism that I learned this year? Is that the Siberian foxes, the Russian fox experiment that's been going on for, you know, over half a century was really born not out of Lysenkoism, but the reason that they used foxes for this domestication experiment and not another kind of dog like a wolf or anything else is because they were able to do the experiment without the Russian government catching on under the guise of it happening in the fox trade, because they weren't allowed to do genetic experiments at that time.
Right.
So they were able to use, fur trappers and go to these different fox trade areas and do it kind of under the cover of darkness. And that's how it was born.
Mm-hmm. Ideology and science don't mix.
Yeah.
Nope.
Very dangerous. That's my go-to example of how bad it can get. And the fact that it's coming back is astounding.
I don't think there could be anything worse than Flat Earth. I mean, that just is an utter denial of
the end game,
of the shared reality that we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the excuse, like, I'm too busy taking care of my kids to know what's going on in the world of science. Fly anymore.
Yeah, but it's not even that, you know, Sherry Shepherd kind of ignorance of what's going on. It's like, oh no, you know, NASA is guarding the ice ring around the planet. And, okay, but how does this work? It's perspective. No, wait, it's not perspective. I showed a flat earther a picture I took of the moon from Australia, and the moon is upside down.
Mm-hmm. Compared to
what we're used to seeing in the northern hemisphere.
That, to me, that is the best example.
That's QED.
It's and dirty. Yeah. There's really no way to really misinterpret. Like, here, I took this. Look, the moon is upside down.
Because you're on your head, relatively speaking.
Yes.
Because the world is a sphere.
That was beautiful. You don't need to talk about boats going over the horizon. That picture will do it. I mean, it's simple, quick, easy, and still.
They said it's perspective. I'm like, explain to me the perspective. Here's a drawing. I drew him a picture of why it looks upside down with the spherical Earth model. Show me on the flat Earth how you get to an upside down moon when you go to the southern hemisphere. Nothing. Crickets.
But, or how do they explain just the pictures of Earth that have been taken from space? They're all fake.
Oh, yeah.
And if you look,
that's why I used the picture I took.
Right.
Yeah.
but it's just so pernicious, because if you show them a picture, they will take a picture of the Earth. They zoom in and they see clouds. They
pixelated see clouds. Or something.
No, they're not pixelated. They're actually duplicated.
Oh, I see.
And the problem is because they basically, it's a composite.
It's a mosaic.
It's a mosaic.
So
it's not a picture of the Earth from so far away you could see the entire Earth. It's really a mosaic. So you have some weird artifacts. Okay, fine. There's artifacts. But there are pictures of the entire Earth that have been taken.
Yeah, there are.
And you will not see, any mosaic artifacts on it. But of course,
those are Photoshopped.
I think those are fake as well, of course.
I'd be curious to see what the reaction would be if you took a flat earther up into a legit spacecraft that got high enough
to see the curvature.
To really see what was going on. I think that they would say things like, oh yeah, that's not a window, that's a video screen that I'm looking at. Like,
oh God.
Be in total denial.
Put him in a suit and have him go out on a spacewalk. Yeah. Then what would they say? Oh, you drugged me and
whatever.
I don't know.
It was all a dream.
I reject your reality, right? That's it.
But they didn't science themselves into that belief. You're not going to science them out of it.
Yeah. So as much of a jaded skeptic as I am after 20 years of doing this, I was still able to be surprised
at
the comeback of that level of reality denialism.
It makes me want to puke.
Yeah, it's just,
I know, right?
Headbanging.
Might help you lose weight, Bob. That's about as good as it gets. What's the next one? Segment number two, right?
That surprised me.
A surprise.
Okay.
So for me, this was a science news item. This is TRAPPIST-1. Remember, this was the, this is the red dwarf that's about as big as Jupiter, more massive than Jupiter. It's close, 39 light years away. They found seven planets.
Earth size.
Three or four of them were in the Goldilocks zone.
Right.
But even the other ones are in a zone where they could still have liquid water. And the thing that really shocked the hell out of me is that if you take all seven planets and you brought them to our solar system and put them between the sun and Mercury, that's where they are orbiting that red dwarf.
Wow. Crazy.
Within the orbit of Mercury.
What?
So that means that if you're on any planet and you look, you will see bigger than the moon, you will see a planet, crescent planets. Can you imagine the view from
the
these worlds?
Would that affect their tides?
Sure. I mean, first off, most of them are tidally locked. So one side is facing the red dwarf. And so sure. I mean, I'm trying to think how far some of them would be. There would be tidal effects, I'm sure. But, you're so close to a red dwarf. You're tidally locked.
That was the first time I realized, I hadn't thought about it, that you could be on a planet where you see other planets like we see our moon.
Yeah.
Or bigger.
Multiple planets.
Can you imagine the vista looking up in the sky and there's multiple planets
in the sky?
That would be gorgeous.
So that really shocked me. When I heard that there were seven planets, I'm like, wow. I mean, that's amazing in and of itself. Seven planets in one solar system. All of them could have life. But to find out that they're all squished into Mercury's orbit.
Check this out. I mean, if Earth was one of those planets, we could use our technology today to see aliens on the other planets. We could just use our telescope.
Well, not just that. Jay, because those planets are so close, if one planet has life, probably all of them have life. Because, right, they would all see each other. All you need is one good meteorite to throw stuff into space.
Oh, they're mixed
up,
sure.
You know, there's Mars rocks on Earth. There's probably the Earth rocks on Mars and the Moon. So that one surprised me.
That was awesome.
That was such a nice icing on the cake.
Just recently, by the way, they discovered the eighth planet in an exosystem. So that's the record now. Number of planets in one system. Same number as ours. Eight.
Cool.
I forget which one it was, but yeah.
Until we find Planet Nine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Planet Nine from outer space.
Which we also talked about.
Oh, and in case you were worried, the planets, you would think that the planets would crisscross. The planets are actually harmoniously resonant in such a way.
Yeah.
The orbits are feeding off each other in such a way that it makes it very stable.
Oh,
and they're not gonna crash. So that's pretty cool.
Well, that's generally true.
Yeah, even in our solar system.
In any solar system, the bodies that survive for millions or billions of years are in some kind of stable, gravitationally stable orbit. If it weren't, it would have gone into the sun or been flung out. And it's interesting to think that most worlds that get made in the solar system get flung out of the solar system and they're wandering between the stars as rogue planets. Yeah, there may be more rogue planets out there than planets locked in the solar system.
I wonder if we'll ever be able to grab a rogue planet with some future engine technology and move it and jockey it. Like, I know this is so sci-fi, but I like to think about this interesting idea of, well, we would take a planet, put it in the opposite side in our orbit on the sun, so you have two planets that are in the same orbit that can house life. Now, you just told me something I didn't know. Adding a planet into our solar system would screw up everybody's orbits.
Yeah, it could. Yeah,
so
it could
dangerous.
Have some nasty side effects.
Yeah. Okay. So I won't think about that anymore.
But the other cool thing about these rogue planets, not only may there be more rogue planets not bound to any one star in our galaxy than regular planets, not only that, life could exist on these. And you're thinking, well, how could that be? There's no parent star. But I mean, you know, with the decay of metals in the planet, I mean, you've got a heat source. Look, the center of our Earth is, we're 4.5 billion years old, still hot as hell. It's still as hot as the surface of the sun. So with that decay, you could heat, like the bottom of the ocean would like never freeze.
You know? Or you could be a moon of a Jovian planet and have, tidal heating.
Yep. Tidal heating is another good source. It's funny to think that you could literally have the atmosphere like raining down as snow.
Yeah.
You know, the oxygen, nitrogen, whatever, but under the bottom of the ocean could stay liquid, would stay liquid for millions of years.
And similar, we just talked about extremophiles that can survive with very little to almost no light whatsoever, no heat or no.
Oh yeah, chemo. Yeah,
heat
yeah explain that, Steve.
Chemosynthesis.
So and added to that is there are probably as many stars floating between galaxies as there are stars in galaxies. So our example of a planet around a star in a galaxy may be the exception rather than the rule when it comes to places where life exists in the universe, you know?
Right, we need some good science fiction that capitalizes on that cool idea. I mean, how creative and unique would that be to have a planet or a star that's not bound to a galaxy, or a planet not bound to a star? What kind of life?
Yeah.
I mean, how advanced could you really get, though, if you're in a water-based environment? I guess that's a long discussion.
Right.
But interesting, though.
All right. So let's move on to the best and worst of 2017, including the SGU. So we need you guys to tell us in the comments, what was your favorite bit, your favorite interview, the favorite thing that we talked about this year? You know, we have been getting some feedback already. So a lot of people liked our interview with Britt Hermes.
Yeah.
I know there's always a bias towards the most recent interviews because that's
absolutely
the ones you remember better. But I think objectively, that was a great interview. It was very interesting. Even though I knew her story, I didn't know a lot of the details.
Plus, she was, we were digging into the emotional aspect.
Yeah.
What was it like to live through those moments?
And just for the quick background, I mean, you could listen to the whole interview, but She's a former naturopath.
Yeah, go listen. We'll wait a little while.
Who discovered shortly after, you know, entering practice as a naturopath that her entire profession was a scam.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And she had the courage and the fortitude to extricate herself from that at great personal cost.
Not easily.
And just an amazing, amazing and really brave and heroic story that she had to tell. And so I'm not surprised that a lot of people connected to that interview and felt that how powerful it was.
I also think a lot of times it's much more meaningful for us. I think that it speaks to the nature of the experience more when you hear it from the horse's mouth. You know, when you talk to an anti-vaxxer who then understood the value of vaccination, I think sometimes it can be so much more effective than when you talk to somebody who has always understood the value of vaccination, because there's an empathic angle to it that is sometimes missing. And so for a lot of people, I think Britt's story resonates because they're like, oh, I remember that time when I got acupuncture and I thought it was working. Or, you know, I had that person in my life who went to a naturopath. And because she was there, hook, line, and sinker, she was in it. And then she saw the error of her ways.
Yeah.
And really went to great personal struggle to get out of it. I mean, this woman is so deeply in debt from her educational expenses that she may never be able to study in America again.
Mm-hmm.
It's intense. I definitely, you know, her story has always spoken to me, and she's become a very good friend of mine as well.
Yeah.
She's a very cool person.
Massive level of humility that she has. Her worldview had to change. You know, she was engaged with something that was making her feel like a bad person. You know, that was a huge push for her, where I think a lot of people may have continued to ignore it. I think she said it in the interview, that they do realize what she came to.
Yeah.
And they stay because it's their career and it's their bread and butter, so they can't do anything. I was totally impressed, and I'm really happy that she had the nerve to not only do what she did, but to go public with it and to, you know, to come and allow people to interview her. It's an important story. To me, one of the most important skeptical stories I think I've ever heard. All right, but my favorite thing that we did, that I did, that I felt like I was significantly involved in, oddly, is the Star Trek promo that we made for the show.
Yeah.
Right? So the backstory was, you know, we want to do something fun for our listeners. So instead of just saying, hey, become an SGU member, you know, you can go
course, yes, please become an SGU member. Go to theskepticsguide.org, become a member. You can help support us. But we wanted to do something fun. So we're like, let's come up with these funny promo bits. And we all talked. What should we do? What movies could we riff off of? You know, we come up with a list of all these different ways that we can come up with bits, like a little 30-second or 1-minute commercial we can put on the show that would be entertaining for our listeners. And the first one, we're like, gotta do classic Star Trek, right? Yeah. Star Trek, the original series. And I had so much fun post-producing that whole thing. It was a joy to hear all those sound effects. I have them all memorized.
Jay and I were driving up here tonight and he played that for me. I hadn't heard it in months. That promo is awesome. Yeah. First off, your sound effects were spot on, perfect.
Well, they're the real thing.
The way you inserted them at the appropriate time, there's a lot of choices. You could have picked a lot of different sound effects. You picked the perfect ones, but you guys wrote it beautifully because the beats are perfect. Nothing was wasted. It was just to me, it was like the perfect promo and it was hilarious.
We've done that one. We did Harry Potter.
I was giggling like a little kid.
That was fun. And then, did so we ever do the?
Oh, finished
the Wizard of Oz.
We're producing.
We're kind of. It's, yeah. it's
right, so we did a Wizard of Oz one, which we're post producing.
My favorite part of the Harry Potter one was when Evan goes, "That's easy." very end. I love that. It's awesome.
Hey, if you have any ideas for other themes we could use, I want to do the one I want to write next because we already wrote and recorded the Wizard of Oz one. They're just doing post production. I want to do one based on Full Metal Jacket.
I'm
the drill sergeant.
Oh yeah,
that's going to be.
Who said that? What is your major malfunction?
How are we not?
Oh, I really, really want to do a Simpsons promo.
Oh yeah,
do a Simpsons.
Oh, we're going to get 100 suggestions.
Yeah, I wonder if they would let us use their music though.
That's the problem we ran into in Wizard of Oz, right? You couldn't have. There was no music.
That's right.
Yeah, Potter had a problem, but Jay. Solve that one.
I got a Harry Potter ripoff music. Yeah. Somebody just asked where can they see our Star Wars reaction. You can go to facebook.com/Alpha Quadrant 6.
The number 6.
We have a 1 hour and 7 minute, I believe, Star Trek review where we took the gloves completely off. I went off the rails. I really did.
You were animated.
I was nuts that night. I was pissed, happy, and everything.
Night.
So
it's also on our YouTube channel, the Skeptics Guide YouTube channel. Yeah.
Yeah. And other listeners right now are typing in. They want to see Futurama. They want us to do a Star Wars promo.
Star Wars would be cool.
But yeah, keep sending ideas in, guys. You know, movies, TV shows, moments in history, right? Could be something there.
Any other comments about best and worst of the year?
There were so many terrible things this year.
This has been a rough year.
It's been very hard to keep up with the news and everything that's going on.
We'll survive. Yeah. We'll be fine. This is a speed bump, but it is disheartening, you know, to take that one step back, you know, when you're trying to take two more steps.
All right.
Forward.
Two people came in with awesome ideas.
Get smart
and Rick and Morty. Oh my God. Rick and Morty could be amazing. Oh, we're going to do it.
Rick and Morty.
Yep.
Oh boy.
Yep.
Would you believe a 1 to 3,000 dilution? Get Smart. I love Get Smart. That's one of those shows.
To this day, Steve and I.
Yeah. But it's also one of those things that I quote to my daughters who have never seen it. Like all these Get Smart quotes. They don't realize until they're older and they finally get exposed to it that I've been quoting it all of these years.
Yeah. I love it.
The best example of that was Monty Python and the Holy Grail. When they saw that movie for the first time, it's like every 10 or 15 minutes they look at me like, that's where you got that from.
Yeah.
So I quote that movie just as part of my vocabulary,
And Kara, you've been on the show 2 years. You're already picking up on a ton of our inside jokes. Mm-hmm. Kara's always like, what's that from? Why are you laughing? Why is that funny?
Time bandits. Time bandits.
But Kara's actually so infused at this point, she's starting to like do the stuff that we do. But there are bits
she's
that
being
we have.
Assimilated, yeah.
Like we'll have a joke, and it'll occur to me, like, where's that from? We have no recollection of the source of the joke. It's just a thing that we say.
So disconnected from the original.
Some of them we just
and sometimes it doesn't even sound like it. Like you guys will tell me what it's from, and then I'll listen to it and be like, it has evolved so much.
Yeah, that happens too sometimes. Yeah. We make it better.
Mushy brains.
We can't help but make it better.
Because now 300 is 100. It's 500. 300. It's anything 100.
Yeah, anything
300.
300. So you know what I want to do? When we start the podcast recording every Wednesday, for some reason, we have all developed this thing where Steve goes, okay, we're going to start recording in, you know, 3, 2, 1.
No, 1, 2, 3, record.
Record. And we all hit record. And right then, we all freak out.
We test our audio.
Yeah, we're like, huh, right. Huh, right. Like, it's check, like everybody check, does test, their test, own right. weird shit, and I want to
wait,
take,
here's
like,
my, here's my Steve impersonation. Testicles. Testicles.
And it's funny every time, even though it's been happening for so long. I want to take a montage of like 30 or 40 of those and expose them to our premium members.
The clean ones, I only clean trust, ones only. Please.
I only trust our premium members because these are opinion-changing audio pieces.
Yeah, you never look at us the same way, right? Or listen to us the same way again.
Yeah. Maybe when we end the show, we'll put that up as like one of the last posts.
We did get it. So I'm getting back to like the favorite bits. We got a couple of mentions for our in-depth discussion of the historical Jesus, which I like that bit too, because that was one, there are every now and then, you know, we get to a topic where it's like, okay, I have to take a deep breath and take a step back and say, I got to like do a deep dive on this for weeks and like really wrap my head around this before we can talk about it. And that was one. That was one where I'm like, I sort of know this, but I feel like there's a layer of scholarship here that I need to dig down to before I think I could talk about this fairly. And then, you know, sometimes it works. Sometimes we don't get quite there. But I thought that was one where we got to a good place. It was a great discussion. We had really good reaction to it. I agree with that as a vote. I think the net neutrality one, the second time around, was a similar topic.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about net neutrality, and then we got a lot of listener feedback on that. And then we all went back in and did some more research, and we found out that, yeah, it is actually amazingly complicated.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
No, but it's not like
they don't get less complicated, they get more complicated.
You know, it's hard to talk about topics like that. You know, even our show, which is very long, you know, the podcast is an hour and a half. After post-production, you know, it's an hour and a half. We record about 2 hours and 15 minutes. And we do that partly because we don't know when to shut up.
On a good day.
Right, Kara? I know. There are nights, I was just saying this last time we were recording, I was telling these guys, there are nights where like, my ass hurts so bad. I'm sweaty. I'm hunched over. I'm going to bed. I'm 200 years old. I can't even walk. And then remember we were talking about the foot cramp? Like we get a foot cramp and you can't walk. You're like, oh my God, I can't even walk anymore. I can't walk. You know, like, that's how hard it is to record this podcast. But Steve whittles it down. And even still, like even when we put in as much as we could about the news item, the net neutrality, it was a whole second news item just to get it to the point where, you know, we did talk about it enough. Yeah. But, you know, the lesson for us is always, like, we always read our listener feedback. Yeah. We always are willing to sharpen the pencil and go deeper and infuse more. And Steve Harris, who is a friend of the show, we've talked about him. Steve was giving us dozens of emails, like, schooling us on the whole
thing. I remember when we were interviewing Christopher Hitchens, and he said that you write your piece about a topic, and then all the people that you should have spoken to come out of the woodwork and contact you with the information. Sometimes we have to do that. It's like, okay, we're going to give an overview of this topic, and then the world experts who happen to be listening to our show are going to contact us and give us the real information.
Yeah.
And then we'll go deeper the next time we deal with it. So sometimes that's like, you know, that's just part of the process of getting to the information that we need, you know.
And it's great because sometimes layers are revealed that you're like, holy crap, this is way more complicated than I thought it was, you know. And even if you had a decent understanding of it, the experts are still laughing. Like, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, come on.
They live it.
Right. The thing is, we know that's the case when we're dealing with physics and astronomy.
Sure.
We know that's the case. We have again, there's always like the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns.
Right.
So we know enough about science topics that we are enthusiasts about. We're not experts, but we know enough to know what we don't know.
Yep.
But then there are topics where we don't even know what we don't know.
And that's
what we learn when we talk about it on the show, whether we plan on talking about it or not. And then people contact us at least to give us an idea of what we don't know. You know what I mean?
And they'll often say, you guys were right as far as you went, but look at these other layers underneath that really blow your mind. And they often,
that's a science communication challenge. Because even when I know those layers, they're like, even though I'm talking about a neurological topic where I know all the layers, it's like, how deep do I go when I'm talking about this topic? You know, you have to make decisions about what's an appropriate level of
complexity.
That's
why I throw a lot of qualifiers.
Yeah.
Like, all right, you got to throw these qualifiers in there because you can't make absolute statements because you will be called on those absolute
statements.
Yeah,
like to the best of my recollection, Senator. Right? That's something we should say.
when they call me to talk about taxes, it depends. Yeah. Like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, A, P.
You have to be humble too. I gotta tell you, like, the best education of my life has been this podcast because I read dozens of news items and have to, you know, wrap my head around stuff I never thought I would even try to wrap my head around. I mean, Bob, your physics education is amazing at this point.
It sucks.
It sucks. I know. It's not like you have a formal education, but you really have developed a aptitude for it.
It's good for like a layman's understanding, sure. But I mean, I just can't help but think of, you know, people who really
you talk to
physics.
Brian Weck and you're like, oh, yeah. I don't know it.
Yeah, but yeah. but I can you know, I can, yeah, I can communicate the, you know, the interesting superficial stuff, but there's so many, like, I mean, just the mathematical layers underneath what I talk about. It's like, whoa, that's so intimidating. Yeah. But, you know, we'd put everyone to sleep if I was talking math. So that's, and it's hard.
Or maths.
Yeah. Or maths.
So,
I mean, if I could just get somebody interested in a topic without making horrible mistakes, I'm happy.
Right. It's fine.
All right. Is it time for Skeptical Hero and Skeptical Jackass of the
yes.
Year?
Yes. Sure.
Well, Steve, you claimed the biggest jackass. Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's mine.
The Goop and the whole thing with Gwyneth Paltrow this year, what a travesty. I mean, she dove head first into the a-hole swimming pool. I mean,
this is, of course, with Goop, which is her, like, modern lifestyle brand. Yeah, they actually won the Rusty Razor Award for worst pseudoscience this year. And what really pisses me off, it's like, essentially, they're just making shit up to sell stuff and make money. That's the worst.
The NASA stickers.
The worst.
Right? Yeah, the Goop stickers. It's just magic. So this was like just such a brazen example of throwing all morality and ethics to the wind and saying, yeah, we're going to market nonsense and pseudoscience mainly to women too. I mean, but to everybody. And just to make money. And it's just going to be, you know, and then, you know, we're going to tell them horrible medical advice. We're going to promote cranks and quacks and, you know, and anti-science and medicine all as a lifestyle brand. Yeah. Pseudoscience is a lifestyle. So she totally gets my vote for Jackass of the Year with her Goop sticker.
You know, I don't know what she really thinks or believes.
She doesn't. Like, in interviews when people ask her point blank, like, do you believe in this? She's like, I don't know.
That's right.
Like, she doesn't think that deeply about it, I don't think.
Maybe not.
And I have to say that I feel like what she's doing with Goop is really not that different than what Alex Jones does with InfoWars.
Yeah, very good point.
It's just a much prettier marketing package. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, and that's yours for this year, right, Alex Jones?
Yeah, he's on my list, certainly.
Oh,
Alex Jones, you know, he stirred up a lot of controversy and things this year. I know we talked about it. Is he actually playing the character of Alex Jones? Or is that who he really is? And it all came about as the result of the lawsuit and the divorce that he
I think it's pretty clear. My opinion is it's an act. He doesn't believe anything. He basically, again, he's targeting a vulnerable population, vulnerable in that they're gullible, right? He's like, I know what I'll do. I will, you know, talk to the conspiracy theorists because they're easy marks, right? And then, you know, essentially he develops a conspiracy and then sells a product that's geared towards the conspiracy.
Yes.
Right. Yep.
You know, and it's pretty clear he's just a snake oil salesman and everything else is his shtick. And he basically admitted it this year.
And it ties in actually to Gwyneth Paltrow, because there's this one article I found in which her name is Amanda Bacon. She's the founder of wellness brand Moon Juice. Moon Juice, that's a brand.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Alternative medicine ingredients in their products are sold very different branding. They sell the same stuff on InfoWars website as they do at Goop. They just change the marketing around to satisfy the audience. It's the exact same potions and nonsense.
Genius!
Their connection.
Right.
Jones and Paltrow.
I've really got to thank John Oliver, though, because, you know, this Jones guy, I mean, you think you know him, right? Yeah, he spouts all this crazy stuff, and does he believe it? Does he not believe it? But I didn't realize until I saw John Oliver's episode, Last Week Tonight, saying that they looked at the whole thing, the whole gestalt, and they're like, he spouts nonsense, but it's really a
connected
tie-in.
It's connected
to the selling all of the snake oil.
Facts.
And it put a completely new spin on him. Now he's not just some crazy
conspiracy theorist. This guy is
a huckster.
He's a con artist.
Money, and that's a, I mean, wow. I did not know that until Oliver clued me in.
And I'm happy you brought Oliver up because, listeners wrote in saying he's a skeptical hero of the year, and he is for me, without a doubt.
He does a great job. He does a great job, generally speaking, of doing a good, you know, in packaging a good talk about a lot of these topics. You know, and, you know, a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago, there was a survey. They asked people, like, where do you get your news from? And then they asked them questions about current events. The best informed viewers were John Oliver's viewers. Mm-hmm. The worst, of course, were Fox News viewers.
And
on that survey.
John Oliver would be my number one interviewer. I'd love to talk to him.
I'm trying to figure out how to get him.
If anyone has it in, let us know.
Yeah. Let me text him now. See if he's busy.
When we used to watch Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, you know, they were on Comedy Central, and so they had to deal with some more censorship than I think John Oliver gets to have on HBO. And I think that they've all of these guys have historically done a really good job of educating the masses in those respects. But I think John Oliver, even though, you know, none of this is like truly original reporting, he does repackage reporting a lot that's like, you know, PBS, like really high quality, like Frontline recording and stuff. But what he does so well is message in a really skeptical way. Yeah. Like, here's what you thought you knew, but let me show you why it's so much worse than that. Yeah, right. And he has been a champion of a lot of skeptical issues. Yeah. And it kind of surprised me because I don't know if he would even consider himself a skeptic or know that he is one.
He talked about p-hacking.
Yeah.
P-hacking on his show. That's the only other place that I heard about p-hacking outside of science-based medicine literature. You know what I mean? So
what if one of his writers listens to SGU?
I suspect that he has one or more of his writers are plugged into the skeptical social
community.
Media.
Yeah. You know, I think so.
I mean, especially with the p-hacking, I'm like, they had to read that on science-based medicine. I mean,
who else is popular?
Would they get that? I mean, I guess they could have read about it in a Nature article or something.
Yeah, or Scientific American. People have written about it, but it definitely is in like a total nerd, area for sure.
It's in a sliver.
Oh yeah,
he definitely got it from
it. Totally got it right.
But don't forget, he's not just packaging these great little news item nuggets. Don't forget, he's hilarious.
He's hilarious.
When you can package something that's correct and skeptical and accurate and funny, I mean, that's like that's a holy grail. Yeah. I mean, that's, you're going to suck in people. They're going to remember it.
Yeah.
They're going to believe it. That, if you could do
that's
that,
a staff of writers, by the way.
And that, but that's also, that's, you know, I say that not to denigrate him because, the first line is the really good investigative reporting, you know, it's the ProPublica, it's the Frontline. Yeah. But then what John Oliver does so brilliantly is he editorializes on top of that in a way that really speaks to people. So when you watch it, you're like, I get it. And you didn't have to watch an hour-long dry documentary. Yeah. You could watch this really funny thing that took 30 minutes and walk away being so much more enlightened.
Right. He covers stuff that's not easy to cover.
But doesn't it?
Exactly.
It blows my mind that the world is so weird today that this is a show that is, you know, it's entertainment. It's comedy and entertainment.
He's a comedian. Yeah.
That happens to be relevant.
But I doubt that he would support that message.
No, no, no.
You know what I mean?
He's always very clear to say, I'm just a clown. I'm a buffoon. Don't take me seriously. Very self-deprecating in that way, which is a great strategy in and of itself.
Sure.
Because whenever anyone makes fun of him or criticizes him or insults him, he just owns it. He ups them. Yeah. He goes, I'm a buffoon. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And then his team orchestrates these brilliant campaigns, like these Twitter hashtag campaigns, or these letter writing campaigns.
And
they actually have an impact, which is super cool.
Yeah. What do you got, Ed?
Hero.
Yeah, I'm gonna nominate the heroes of the year as the science moms. Now, we were fortunate enough to be able to say hello and meet some of them when we were out in at the convention in Las Vegas just a couple months ago, and a documentary was made about titled Science Moms, and from what Harriet Hall, I'll just read you a few of her comments about it. In the documentary, a group of scientists and science communicators who are also moms addressed misperceptions created by misinformation in the media about GMOs, vaccines, and other issues important to parents. With this documentary, people have another resource based on science, a resource that is easily digestible and compelling. Natalie Newell is the director, Allison Bernstein, Anastasia Bondar, Coven Senapathy.
Synapathy.
Splitter are the science
splitters.
I know, Kara, you had a chance to actually sit down with them and be involved in the panel discussion.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I've interviewed, some on my other podcast, and I've, you know, gotten to know some of these women really well and want to continue the conversation. And I think that, like I mentioned earlier about Brit, there's something that is really effective and really meaningful when the person who is talking to you about an issue is one of yours.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes, you know, no offense, Steve, an old white dude who's a doctor who can tell you all the things that he knows might not reach certain people. But another mom who's like, I understand why you don't want to eat GMOs, because I understand the fear about the stuff that we're putting in our kids' bottles, you know? And then, but this is what I learned, and I'm on your team, can be really effective. Yeah, and so I think it's super cool that they took up that cause.
Especially, and moms are another, parents are another vulnerable population, because parents are freaked out. They're scared. They're, you know, you're now, you are put in charge of this human life, you know, and you're living in a society where you're being scared every day, and your relatives, your friends, your coworkers, your acquaintances come out of the woodwork giving you horrible advice. You know, we get emails probably every day from listeners who are like, you know, I got this thing going on and people are telling me this and I don't know what to believe. It's overwhelming. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. They targeting young parents, young mothers, who are being scared. They are being scared to sell them snake oil. So they need, I think, targeted skepticism and science communication. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, skeptical parenting, right? I mean, you have to, it's hard enough to be a good skeptic, but then when you add the layer of parenting in, there's so much crap out there, and it's so easy to make bad mistakes. And I said this, I talked about this at Nexus last summer. You are emotionally vulnerable when you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, logic, you know, your lizard brain and your cerebral cortex are at war with each other during those decisions. You know, it's like, you gotta keep your cool. You gotta think about what's going on. You know, there's a methodology to it. You know, find a good doctor. How do you do that? You know, your kids start, as soon as you start getting your head wrapped around that, your kid's going to, you know, daycare. What do you do? It's a never ending stream, literally up until they move out at some point.
Yeah, we get emails all the time, and it's so frustrating. It's like, what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, and there is no rule book. There's no one right thing to do, but it must be so difficult when you're at your wit's end and you're like, you know, every time I take my kid to my mother's house, his grandmother's house, she's trying to, you know, put pseudoscience in his head. How do I handle that? It's like, ooh, you know?
It's right up there. The other major vulnerable population that we deal with is people who are sick or have family members who are sick. Because that's, again, when people come out of the woodwork with the pseudoscience. They're trying to be helpful, but they're really, they put a lot of pressure on people who, they're trying to deal with an illness, and then people are trying to guilt them into trying horseshit, and it adds so much stress. We've heard from so many people about how much more stress it adds to their lives when they're trying to deal with it.
Yep.
Just leave them alone with your, you know, inexpert medical advice. Seriously. Don't pretend you're a doctor. Just don't. You know, it's, you're not going to help anybody. You may think you are, but that's hubris. That really is. You know, that's where the humility has to come in. You are not an expert. This is really hard. Medicine is hard. You need a lot of very, very rarefied information, and you need to spend years learning how to think about it in a you know, meaningful way. And then even then, it's hard not to make mistakes. It's hard to keep up with everything you need to do. Again, this is sort of the denialism, pseudoscience that we deal with all the time, where the biggest disconnect that people have with reality is thinking that they know more than the hundreds or thousands of experts who have spent decades of their life dedicated to studying this topic.
Yep.
I just got an email. We got an email from a creationist, not to pick on them, but again, these casual opinions about the evidence. Like, there are no transitional fossils. Really? You really think that you know more than all the scientists who have spent decades studying this?
Didn't they say paleontology is more of an art than a science?
Yeah, you just don't know. You do not know. And again, and we know, that's something like, I know a lot about, as much as any non-expert can. I'm not obviously a paleontologist. I'm a massive enthusiast about evolution and paleontology. So I, it's one of those things I feel like I know a lot as a layperson.
Yeah, without humility, your level of knowledge in it is dangerous.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I know enough to think, that without the humility, the generic humility, I could think that I actually know what's going on. Yeah. But I realize I don't. I just try to understand what the experts think. They're the ones who are allowed to have opinions because they know, you know, they're in the technical literature, right? And then they're summarizing it for a layperson. I'm just trying to understand as much as I can that the experts are summarizing for me.
Same as that with me when I'm talking about some of my science. Yeah. It's like, I'm not making up some new ideas. Here, check this out. This is a summary of what the experts who know their shit. What they're saying. And that's a lot of what we
That's what we've been seeing decay, though. That's what's going on in society.
But you could know enough at that level to know when someone is completely talking out their ass. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, but you have absolutely no idea what the evidence is. Now, we'll see. I'm just beginning a conversation with this person. We'll see if they're just misinformed. I suspect that that may be the case. Should we do in memoriam?
Yeah.
In memoriam?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. All right. So, we lost Eugene Cernan this year. You guys remember who that
Gene
is?
Eugene Cernan, the astronaut.
The last human being to step foot on the moon.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's sad that it's been so long.
Yeah.
How much longer is he going to have that title of the last human on the moon?
Probably not too much longer.
I hope
not. Another generation, would know. I think.
Paul Weitz, who was the first commander of the Challenger, another NASA alum also died this year. H. Boyd Woodruff. He did the foundational research that allowed us to harvest antibiotics from soil, which is a huge, we talked about this on the show before, it's a huge source of antibiotics because bacteria, soil bacteria, make antibiotics to fight off other bacteria, right? And in fact, we talked recently, like in the last year or so, about new techniques, basically figuring out how to culture soil bacteria better, which might really enable us to harvest a lot more antibiotics from the soil bacteria.
Hurry up. Hurry up. We need it right away. What are you waiting for? We're dying.
Mildred Dresselhaus. Was she a forgotten superhero? Yeah. So fundamental research into the nature of carbon. So like, you know, carbon nanotubes, all that stuff wouldn't exist unless we knew how carbon is a fascinating element. Really.
Oh, carbon's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's just right in that perfect spot on the periodic table, you know?
Do so many things attached to so many elements. It's awesome.
It's a wonder element.
Says the carbon-based life form.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Peter Mansfield invented the MRI scan.
Yep.
That's my whole profession depends
on
that.
Thank you very much.
Jay, this one really cuts very close to home for you. Hugh Hefner.
Yeah,
I know.
His robe and slippers and all.
You know, think about what that guy achieved in his life. It's pretty impressive.
But
you know, as far as famous people go, though, there's someone else that was much more meaningful to me. Hey, lady! Oh, man. Jerry Lewis at his prime. There was a Jerry Lewis movie that I showed Bob where he's lying in bed and he does something weird and grabs his own head and it's like the weirdest little maneuver. It was like, this is like 30 years ago, Bob. I remember laughing my ass off. When Jerry Lewis was young and doing that weird,
king of physical comedy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I love that. So there's one scene, I can't remember the movie, but his job is to bring the folding chairs into the big auditorium, and there's like thousands of chairs, and they're on rollers, so you can roll out 100 at a time. He goes in, takes one chair off the roller, brings it in, and sets it down, and the guy who told him to do it was just shaking his head. Then he comes back 5 minutes later, and they're all set up. It's a funny bit. But Jerry Lewis is on the list, because you don't talk about every celebrity who passed away, but he ran the telethon for the Muscular Dystrophy Association, the MDA. I mean, this is an important organization, obviously close to my work. You know, we have an MDA clinic at Yale where I work. I worked very closely with them for years. And they provide a lot of, not only money for research, they provide mainly support for patients. Incredible amount of support of patients with not just muscular dystrophy per se, but a list of 50 or 60 neuromuscular diseases. And Jerry Lewis was a huge boost to that organization by running. Did you guys remember staying up
for the telethon?
For the 24-hour telethon
that was
every year?
That was part
of our childhood.
Jerry's watched that every year.
It was an event.
Hours and hours. And because the entertainment that would come on. I mean,
he would bring out the A-list.
Oh my God.
Gosh,
the stars one after the other. And then you could hold your breath waiting for that rollover, you know,
the rollover to the
millions.
Yeah, yeah.
My God, for years we watched that. It's a weird thing.
It was entertaining.
Yeah, it was fun.
Good man.
Stay up late.
So, guys.
Good legacy.
We forgot an important skeptical in memoriam this year, which is Dr. Colin Groves, who actually just passed away November 30th. He, if you don't know, was a professor of biological anthropology. He was a primatologist in Canberra. And he was one of the two professors who described Homo ergaster. Mm-hmm. And he was an active member of the Australian Skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, we lost. Was that this year that we lost David?
David Young.
That was this year.
Yeah, David. Mm-hmm. David was, you know, so much to say about him. But in short, David brought skepticism to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And Hong Kong, it is a very difficult place to push skepticism. It's very sad. I mean, David and I had talked so much and had a lot of simmering plans that would have taken root this year and next year. So I'm still very upset about that.
And I feel really honored because, of course, I just got back from Hong Kong a few weeks ago. I was there speaking to the Hong Kong skeptics and then in mainland China to the Dongguan skeptics. And I got to know a lot of David's close friends and a lot of his colleagues. And I know how hard he worked just to make that trip happen, you know, and like one of the things that he was really pushing for as he was dying was to make sure that these tours of skeptics coming to visit Hong Kong continue. So I'm really honored that even though I didn't get to meet him in person in his life, I feel like I know him because I met so many people whose lives he touched.
He was a great guy. I mean, he was, I think, the one person that I met in the skeptical movement who just very consciously and conscientiously decided, I'm not in this for my own, you know, fame or personal aggrandizement or credit or anything. I am perfectly content to just be, to support skepticism, to support other skeptics, just to try to grow, you know, the movement for everybody.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, completely selfless in his dedication to the skeptical movement. Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, really, really, you know, sad to see him go.
And ALS.
Yeah, he died. Familial ALS. Right. His father died of ALS and he inherited it, unfortunately. And that's one of the things that, you know, like CRISPR could cure in a year or two.
Yeah, could you imagine?
Which would be great, but I mean, would be add a layer of sadness too that he might have missed something like that by just a couple of years, but we don't know, but that's just highly plausible because that is something where it's a mutation in a gene. And if you fix that mutation, it'll be better.
It's gone. Yeah.
You know, that's the low hanging fruit, you know, in terms of like CRISPR curing diseases, you know?
You know, we lost our dad this year.
Yeah.
Dad was 86. You know, it's something that takes, you could be years before you digest it and get over it, but, you know, my dad was a heavy influencer on us as brothers and the way we think and the way we talk. And, you know, the vibe that we have in this podcast is derivative of our dinners.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was the conversations we had growing up, you know, and that came from my dad.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that mom was a massive influencer as well, but, you know, dad was the sci-fi. Dad was Star Trek to us. Dad was taking us to history.
Yeah, but I do not want to take away from mom as well, because honestly, from my perspective, our mother and our father had very complementary kind of intellectual talents.
Yeah,
right?
They were counterparts.
They basically complemented each other just so well. Like mom is incredibly knowledgeable, you know, about anything to do with language, very, very fluent and very, you know, smart in very certain ways, you know. And dad was not smart in any of the ways that mom was, but he was smart in completely different ways that mom really wasn't.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's incredible. So dad was where we got a lot of just the enthusiasm for science and science fiction definitely came.
Without a doubt.
From dad.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So who else do you have, Steve?
So there's a few other just science fiction deaths that we had this year. Adam West.
Yeah, Batman.
Yes.
Batman. But, and you know, Adam West had a very active career in the last 5-10 years as a voiceover artist for cartoons. If you have kids.
He was great.
Yeah, if you have kids and you watch cartoons with them, you heard Adam West on a lot of cartoons.
That's right.
It was hilarious.
Often very self-deprecating.
So
very good. And then Stephen First. Remember who he is?
Babylon 5. And also,
Animal House is probably where he first became famous, but John Hurt.
Flounder.
No, John Hurt.
Yeah, Flounder.
John Hurt.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So
man, where am I going to get my wands from now?
Right. Ollivander and also Alien.
1984.
And
well, he was the chess burster, right?
Yeah. Yep. I
mean, he was the elephant man.
Yep. Elephant man.
A very brief stint as the doctor.
Yep.
Oh, that's right.
Yep. Yes, he did.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I loved him.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's great.
He's great. Great.
And Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton.
He improved that line, Bob.
Yeah.
Yep. I really like Bill Paxton. He was a cool dude. Game
and apparently,
oh my gosh, I know.
Science Jay is the weird
science,
brother.
Yeah.
He was
hilarious. Chet.
Yes.
Fisher. Oh, Carrie Fisher.
Of course, Carrie Fisher.
Oh, Carrie Fisher.
That was the end of 16. She died around Christmas.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, but still.
What about her mom? Did her mom pass in 2017? It was right after. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Carrie Fisher was 2016.
She was one of, you know, arguably she could have been one of, or my first crush. I mean Princess Leia was so awesome. I mean, that character to me was so powerful. I mean, in the first scene that you see her, she's standing toe-to-toe with Darth Vader.
Yes. And giving him sass.
Yes. Yeah.
And she's totally sass Darth Vader.
And then when she sees Tarkin.
Yeah.
And says, I thought I smelled your foul stench. It's like, I mean, come on. How cool is that?
She had an English accent.
Yeah.
No, she was adorable in that movie.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She was great. Yeah,
we were 14, 13. I mean, you know, right in the peak age.
Yeah. And she was so capable. My God, she was. Yes. She wasn't taking
how
any
many
crap
strong
from
female roles were there in 1977? She's
a, I know. Think about that.
I mean, how many? A hand.
Yeah. And Star Wars. You know, it's almost a joke that like she's the only female character in the whole movie. You know, but
until now, in that first
trilogy, yeah. Now. Very, very, very different. The new movies have fixed that problem. But at least she was an incredibly strong character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they go to rescue her and she ends up rescuing them. You know,
right.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
Watching The Last Jedi, the scenes with Leia was more poignant knowing that, you know, that she was.
Yeah. Like, yeah, without a doubt.
Away. Yeah.
Yeah. And I brought my son this year to see, this was our first movie alone.
Yeah.
The Star Wars movie. And it was important to me. You know what I mean? It was like, it was really fun and it was really emotional for me to see him enjoy the movie and he's asking me a million questions. It was so freaking cute.
Shall we go on to science or fiction?
Ooh. Yes.
It's time for science or fiction.
So I have a brand new science fiction for this episode.
Okay.
And then we're going to talk about the stats for the year.
Did you record the show we recorded two nights ago?
Okay. Is it two nights ago? No.
What?
I'll have to.
Oh, yeah, Evan, don't give anything away or anything.
We'll have to adjust.
Who won?
All right. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Item number one, a new examination of moon rocks finds that the moon has a small but detectable magnetic field.
What?
Now, the theme here is science news stories that you may have missed from 2007.
Okay.
So science news stories that I can't remember us talking about this year.
Oh, okay.
Any time during the year. Okay. Item number two, scientists successfully tested an artificial womb on sheep.
What?
Artificial womb. And number three, astronomers characterized the orbit of the first known asteroid in retrograde orbit around the sun that also is co-orbitable.
I'm adding that to the list, Steve.
Co-orbitable?
Co-orbitable.
With a planet, in this case, Jupiter. So, the asteroid is basically in the same orbit of Jupiter and going in the opposite direction as everything else in the solar system.
In the same orbit?
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Same orbit, but going backward.
Yeah, retrograde orbit. Jay, you want to go first?
I'll go first. Okay, this first
Don't
one here.
Then,
Whoa. Kara, read this. What does it say? Okay. A new examination of moon rocks finds that the moon has small but detectable magnetic field. I mean, that's pretty believable. I wouldn't be surprised about that. But people are probably laughing at me about how little I know about orbital magnetics, right? Mm-hmm. Is that what they call it, Bob? I mean, yeah, why wouldn't it? I don't know. There's magnetic stuff happening with the moon, right? How does it stay up there? You know? Scientists successfully tested an artificial womb on sheep. Now, when you say on, you mean on sheep or in sheep?
No, out of sheep.
Out of sheep.
Yeah, they took the fetus out of the sheep and put it in an artificial womb and it grew and it was able to survive.
Whoa. So that's kind of like Neo, like ripping out of the thing. All right. That
or
does...
like the orcs coming out of the ground.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What was with that? All right. We don't get into that. Last one here. Astronomers characterize the orbit of the first known asteroid in a retrograde orbit around the sun that is also core orbitable with a planet, in this case, Jupiter. Okay. These are, wow, this is really hard. I mean, the one about the artificial womb to me seems like, okay, think about it. The womb has, not just the sac, but it has the placenta, which is the blood barrier. That as a device, if you think about what it's doing alone, is ridiculously complicated and difficult. And you don't need to eat that, by the way.
Ooh, yeah.
That's the part of it that I don't get. And also, wait, you know, then you have an umbilical cord that's feeding, what would you call it, the sheeplet?
Yeah.
The sheeplet?
Sheeplet?
Lamb?
The lamb? Yes,
are you not saying fetus because it's banned? I don't understand.
Lamb. It's called a flam.
Silence of the fetal lamb.
That's the one where it seems super obvious. Bob, right, Evan? Super obvious that it's the fake, but it's gotta be fake womb outside. They're literally got it hanging in a room, right, Steve? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in the lobby of this.
Science of fiction is so much funnier when I can see Jay's face.
they are all mini panic attacks for me. I can't think of any reason why that I shouldn't pick that one. I'm picking that one. That can't be real,
Evan.
Okay, so you examine the moon rocks to find that it has a small magnetic field. I guess they're able to detect the polarity inside the components of the rocks, right? How it aligns. It aligns in a certain way, and therefore that would be the reveal. Did it actually happen, though? And we missed it?
Yeah, really?
Bob, we missed this? Bob didn't miss it. I think that one's right.
I think Bob
The artificial womb on sheep. I think Jay brought up kind of a good point there. There's a lot of other things going on than just the womb itself. You need a lot of other supporting apparatus and things going on in order to make it happen. The last one about the orbit of the first known asteroid in a retrograde orbit. Oh boy. Seems familiar. I don't think we talked about it in science or fiction. I somehow have this sensation that I briefly saw this news item at some point earlier in the year. So I think that's right. I'm going to go with the,
Okay.
Okay.
Nice.
Bob?
Thank you.
All right, so let's see. The moon has a small but detectable magnetic field. I don't know. I'm not buying that because I thought the core was solid. I mean, if you got a solid core, you don't have a magnetic field, my friend. And how are they detecting that from the Earth? Even if it's there, you're going to detect such a small...
On the moon rocks, by examining the moon rocks.
I missed the word rocks.
I thought you talked about the moon.
The moon has a small...
You
miss one word. Every once in a while, you miss one word.
Oh, like, I know, right? Yeah.
The whole shit.
And then when Crap. Steve reveals it and he says the word, you're like, I don't even remember that word. What?
All right, so I got to look at this in a different way now. The moon has a small...
Hurry up.
I'm still not buying
it. Bob, you're doing
Hurry
it.
Up. Mr. Womb, you would like to spend your
I was teaching you, okay?
The artificial womb, that would be complicated and impressive. Let me jump to the third one here. Yeah, this one's a little scary. The first known asteroid in a retrograde orbit around the sun, co-orbital with Jupiter. How does that even happen?
His face.
It never catches up.
How does that even happen? Well, wait a second. I mean, you find...
This is what goes on every week, by the way. I just edited it out.
Yeah, you're spared the,
And you're just making it longer. Now wait, I mean, we have rocks.
Yes, we have rocks, Bob.
We have rocks
Hurry
that
up.
Are millions of years old that you could see what the orientation of the magnetic field
was
millions of years ago. But that doesn't mean there's a magnetic field now. I mean, so the moon probably had a magnetic field at one point when it was had a molten
core.
Sure,
it did. Yes,
it may still.
The moon has.
Bob,
a small,
you're boring, Steve.
All right, I'm gonna say the astronomy one. I'm just like such crazy stuff happens. I'm gonna say that one is okay. The womb is a little dicey. No, the moon rocks. I'm going to say that's the moon does not have a small but detectable magnetic.
Okay, Kara, do you remember them well enough? I made you go last because you can't read them.
Yeah, maybe. I'm pretty positive that the artificial womb is science. I feel really strongly about that one. Maybe I'm missing something, but I feel pretty strongly about that one. The other two are bothering me. I do know that we discovered some sort of comet that like passed through all of the orbits this year, like this like comet that like divided all of the orbits of the planet, not all of them, but like the inner planets, and actually entered and exited the inner planets this year. And so that's kind of weird. And maybe this comet one is borrowed from that, and that's what he was changing, and that's why it's the fiction. Okay, and so then the other one, the moon rock, bothers me too. I don't understand a stable orbit going the wrong way. That one's the one that really bothers me. So I don't know. The moon rock one, magnets have always been really tough for me. Magnets are very complicated.
Magnets are a miracle.
I don't trust my ability to separate science from fiction on the moon one. I have a moon meteorite, which is really cool. Maybe I should see if it's magnetic. Maybe I should go do a test. No, I'm going to go with, the comet or the asteroid as being the fiction.
Oh, good. Wow. So you guys are all over the place.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That might be it. I think you might have nailed it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Let's start with number two. We'll go in the middle first. Scientists successfully tested an artificial womb on sheep. Jay and Evan, you guys think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
How? Come on. What's with the placenta?
Yeah, this is basically an artificial placenta. That's what they did. So they have the artificial placenta so that you can exchange electrolytes and everything that they need and nutrients and everything. And then they have the umbilical bypass, you know, for the oxygen.
What's the umbilical cord?
It's connected to a bypass machine so that it...
Flexi.
And it worked, and the sheep lived?
Yeah, and they lived.
Jay, it's a machine. It's not like a gooey, fake placenta.
Yeah, I know, but even still...
It's basically a bag. It's like a plastic bag. It's the artificial placenta. Right. Then the umbilical cord's on bypass. So they're thinking of... They might be going to human trials in a couple of years.
Wow. Yeah, but freaking awesome. Years.
You want to see those, Jay?
I mean, that...
Can you imagine you go visit your kid? Hey, baby. You know,
that's amazing. That is really amazing.
It'd be a very great option to have. I mean, there's,
somewhere we can't have, we can't have kids.
They can't bring them to term. They have cancer. They need chemotherapy. Plus, and you have to kill the kid to get the chemotherapy.
Your kid could be developing perfectly. You can go out and get drunk without worrying about it. Smoke, drink, you're all set.
All right, let's go back to number one. A new examination of moon rocks finds that the moon has a small but detectable magnetic field. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Yeah!
Crap!
Boom in it!
And you nailed it, Bob, because the rocks are old, so they won't tell you about the magnetic field today.
Nailed it.
You did nail it. They did examine moon rocks, and they were able to tell by the orientation, that there was a magnetic field at the time that those rocks existed. So that basically moved closer to the present how long the moon did have a magnetic field.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the magnetic field the moon had a magnetic field billions of years ago, but it was for more time than we thought. So it was went up to 2.5 instead of 3.5 billion years ago, something like that.
Sucks,
Bob. Yeah.
Well done, Bob.
Which means astronomers characterized the orbit of the first known asteroid in a retrograde orbit around the sun that also is co-orbital with a planet, in this case Jupiter. It's science. It's cool.
That is awesome.
Now, this is extremely rare because, what? Doesn't make any sense.
A collision.
It shouldn't be a stable
Jupiter
orbit.
Grab that thing?
It's in a resonant orbit with Jupiter. And it's weird because it's three-dimensional. It's not exactly in a plane. So the orbit, it goes it loops around Jupiter and then it goes like this. I mean, it has a two-orbit kind of resonant
thing. Really
that's
cool.
Sweet.
Yeah, so it's a really weird, but stable, at least over millions of years, orbit. And also, just how do things get going in the wrong direction?
I know.
Pretty much everything. Probably a collision, just a fluke. That it just happened to fall into this semi-stable orbit that it's been around for millions of years.
All right, so Bob basically did a good job this
Bob
year.
Bob nailed it.
Yeah.
Well, you want to hear the stats?
Yes.
So these don't include the last two episodes because this is
And this were sent in by who?
These were sent in by Charlie.
Charlie Ross.
Yeah. So here's the overall win percentage.
We had multiple people, by the way, send in.
Yeah,
stats.
We did.
Anyone that sent in sets.
Thank you so much. Yeah, but I think these are. So, Kara was in the lead with 62.8%.
What?
62. Do you think that changed today?
Well, you won yesterday. Yeah, you're. Yeah, you
oh yeah.
Oh, you got
50%
of the last two, so you would drop a little
bit. Dropping a little.
Evan, 58.7%.
I also drop a little bit.
Jay, 55.3%. Bob, 52.1%.
I'm in last.
I beat Bob.
It's not.
Wait, I did better than Bob this year?
It's called a mic drop.
Right? What happened?
Technically, I was last at 50%.
Right.
But I only had four.
Steve was last. Bob,
stop taking your pants off. What are you doing? Get the hell back over here.
Bob.
All right, solo wins. Who had the most solo wins?
Han.
Oh, God.
Evan.
I did.
Evan, okay.
Four.
Oh, like two?
Then who?
Bob at three.
Yeah, second place.
Jay one.
Oh, it was so
Kara
sweet,
zero.
Ah, no Kara, no solo wins. Wait a minute. Really?
What does that mean? That means that I'm the only, like, that solo I never win. Was the only person who won.
Yes, right.
Gotcha.
Solo, yeah.
You know?
Longest consecutive winning streak was Kara at six, then Evan at five, Bob and Jay tied at four.
Jay.
The longest consecutive losing streak was Jay at five, then Bob at four, then Evan and Kara tied at three. Wow, you guys all did a third or worse when answering first.
Yeah, it's tough. You don't
it's
have
the hardest position. You have no other idea.
Jay 20, Bob 16.
But not today.
But oh, not
I didn't
today.
First.
No, you didn't. All right, sweeps.
Sweeps.
I swept you guys five times.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
and
great.
Evan swept us once when
I
he was
did.
A guest.
Mark Twain. Yeah.
You guys swept me seven times.
Yeah.
I'm like, nice. You guys all swept me the same number of times. But yeah, of course.
That's
well, it didn't
fun.
Have to be that way because you might have missed a sweep, I guess, but you all participated in the seventh sweep.
Kara, well done in your overall victory.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we just talk a little more about how I won?
Yes. And good job.
Steve, good job because science fiction is a hard segment to write.
Yeah, it is.
It could be amazingly laborious.
Right.
On
it's,
a bad news week or day, you could be in trouble.
There are weeks when I spend more time doing science or fiction than all of my other prep for the show that week. Seriously.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
That's tough. Hey, but it's such a popular segment, you know, it's worth the work.
Oh, I forgot. What's your favorite noisy from this year, guys?
My favorite noisy?
Yeah.
That instrument one. Goat.
I think I
cued the talking seal?
The theremin.
Whatever the hell that guy.
I like this one.
Was that a dog or a goat? I don't
know. Yeah, the dog. Was that today? Is that this
Who
year?
Did she see? She saw me. Did she see you or hear you? She saw me.
That was the voter.
Do the dog, Jay. Do the dog.
Oh, what? I think my favorite one was this one, the La La dog. This was my favorite one.
That sounds like you, Jay.
Oh my God.
That's epic. That's awesome.
So, that's literally, you guys hear that? That's a guy. He gets his dog getting in that. And then he goes like this with the dog's mouth. It's
la, makes it talk.
La, 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 la. And I saw the video of that and I lost my shit. And then I did a little research and I found out that this is pretty much what this guy does.
Like,
he's got a lot of videos of him having his dog say, la, la. Like, dude.
At some point, you're like, get a life, dude. It's awesome as that.
Yeah, he probably makes more money on those videos than we do on SGU combined.
Yeah, that's right.
$1 million to that guy.
Yeah.
Then the simulated throat. Pink trombone.
That's pretty cool.
It's all the really weird, funny shit that I remember.
Wasn't there like a talking sea lion or something?
Yes,
that, like,
there was.
Plagued me all year.
One. The beluga whale. Here, this one's great.
The guy on a kazoo.
No, this beluga whale is imitating the scientists that I think were studying him, and he could
so
hear them
creepy.
Talking to each other through their. You know, they're underwater speaking devices.
So it's mimicking the noise?
Yeah. I love this segment. It's a lot of fun. It's
you
great.
Want to keep doing it?
Yeah, I do it for another year.
All right.
But if I do the quote again, if I do go back to the quote, I have to start yelling the names again.
Yeah.
Well, some people don't like that, but I love that.
So.
That's a youth.
Yeah.
We occasionally mix things up at the end of the year. We use it as an opportunity to go, how are things going? Is anybody tired of doing anything? Is there anything new that we want to do? I don't know. I think we're in a pretty good groove. I don't know that we necessarily need to make any changes, but we're definitely going to think about it. So it's also a good, this is the time where if you have any suggestions or feedback, let us know what segments do you like? What segments do you not like? What changes would you like to see to segments?
Quickie with Bob.
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, Quickie
more,
with Bob. I haven't had a Quickie with Bob in a while.
I used to do Swingers List, too.
Just say the word.
Yeah, we used to have puzzles.
To do puzzles.
We could do
right?
puzzles back.
Yeah.
Was, you know.
Yeah, or new ideas.
Wait,
yeah,
I've never done puzzles.
Ideas.
What is this puzzle thing?
This is before. This is pre-Kara, PC.
Yeah.
PC Precare. Okay, so I had a lot of fun doing What's the Word this year. I have done 92 words on the show so far.
That's wow. 2 years.
But well, yeah. These 2 years. Yeah, exactly. It was not just in the 1 year, but we are talking about this year. But I did make a great list of made-up words that happened throughout the year.
Oh, so explain what this is. Yeah, give us the context.
So this is usually when Jay can't pronounce a word, but sometimes it's when other people say words incorrectly. And also there are words like testicles and, you know, cromulent that are not real words that we use all the time because they've just become funny. But I'm going to stick with the ones that were accidental made-up words. And I'm going to tell you where they came from. Jay wins for the highest number of them. I want to see. Okay, so geothermical.
That's awesome. Yep.
Geothermical is a tough one. Jay, how do you say infectious? You say infectious.
Infectious?
Yeah.
What's another one that you did, which was so fun?
Paraceralophus.
Paraceralophus. Say it, Jay.
Paraceralophus.
Yeah.
Parathermometer.
Julia could say that name when she was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have it down as parasophilus. That was
parasophilus.
How you
yeah.
That's much paras-
Yeah. It would be easier. You were trying to say senescence at one point or senescent and you said senescent, which was fun. Yeah, senescent. But Evan, you have a couple.
He does.
I know.
Citated.
Oh, that's a good
that's
one.
That's a real word.
Citated.
Which is a good one. Also, when you were trying to remember tonsil stones, what did you call them?
Lung clams.
Lung clams. Oh, man.
That's a good one.
I've ever heard. I think that's my favorite one. Lung clams is so freaking gross. And then Steve, we just got one from you today. Co-orbitable. Yeah.
Co-orbitable.
Co-orbitable.
Bob, you don't trip up enough.
I don't.
Nope. I'm gonna be extra. Yeah, I'm gonna pay extra attention.
Did you have any, Kara? I don't think you had any this year.
Oh, please! If I had them, I wouldn't have written them down.
That's on you. Pay no attention.
She would have erased our memory for them.
Yeah,
like right. Well, guys, this year has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had a great year. Great year for us to you. We have a great year coming up, though, guys. We are decoupled from our unbelievably expensive lawsuit. It's pretty much over. January 13th, we're going to really find out, like, you know, when are we going to get some of our money back? And, but the most important thing is as soon as it ends, we get our cash flow back to do all the things that we couldn't do over the last 3 years, which is hugely important. We started a new show. Alpha Quadrant 6. It's a science fiction review show. That one is fun. That show is just fun.
Half the reason we did it is we want to get into the studio every week. Because we forget how to keep all the plates spinning when we don't do it for too long. So, we pretty much got this down now, I think. I mean, it still feels like, you know, like we're on the Millennium Falcon and things are shorting out and we're always like trying to get things to work. The goal is to do more shows from here. We want to just do more video and more streaming because the studio works and we want to use it. We have a book coming out in 2018.
That's big news.
Skeptics Guide to the Universe book.
A book tour. A book signing tour.
Maybe.
Right?
We'll see.
I don't know. Not necessarily, but there'll be a book.
Okay. Yeah.
Those expectations right on down.
If you love the show, if you love the work that we do, please support us. Of course, we need funding to keep going and the more money we have, the more that we can invest. Please go to theskepticsguide.org. And become a member. There's a link at the top. Become a member. And also we are researching like Patreon, for the SGU.
Other options just to get people ask for different options. Yeah.
But if you do appreciate the work that we do, that would be the number one thing that you could do to help keep us going.
And just keep listening. Spread the word. Tell your friends. Tell people who you think might enjoy the show. Send us your emails and your comments because we very much want this to be a conversation, interactive, not just a monologue. So, but thanks for watching us again for another year. Thanks for downloading us, guys. Thanks for joining me every week on the show. It's so much fun, I have to say. As much as this is work, I really enjoy doing the show with all you guys.
It's our life's work. This is important to all of us. I mean, Kara, I got to tell you, I love working with you. I love having you on the show.
She's all right.
And to be very fair, Kara has been instrumental behind the scenes since she came on. She's given us unbelievable advice
to do things. I mean, Kara is a key player on the SGU. And, Kara, I love you. I appreciate you.
Aw, I love you too.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week and this year.
Thank you.
Good job. To friends, power, activate.
And until next year, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.